or it's the Apostle John that wrote the Gospel of John. And yet, John never identifies himself in that way in the book as the author, at least not directly. But in a lot of other ways, he does identify himself. And so we talked some Wednesday night just about evidence. There is external evidence and there is internal evidence. External evidence just being such things as the secular history, looking at what the historians of the second and third century wrote. And it's surprising the amount of documentation that you can find of those who believed that the Apostle John was the one that was the writer of the book. I just find that kind of thing interesting that way. Of course, there are some who say that it could have been Lazarus, that some of the descriptions in the book, like someone who was, you know, close to the Lord and the one that the Lord loved. Well, there's some application that could be made to men such as Lazarus as well, but not as much probably as John. And there are those who say the book wasn't written till the late 200s or into the 350 A.D. period of time. And yet external evidence, there's some problems for that to be the case. Because there are historians at 200 A.D. like Clement and Tertullian and some such as this who make some references or even some quotes from the book of John. And so that would make a 300 A.D. time of authorship, you know, unreasonable and unlikely. Emily mentioned something to me on Wednesday night that I had read and I had actually meant to put in the notes and I forgot, that I thought was just a really key point. I mean, I think it's one of the strongest points, really, and I left it out. Can you figure that? One of the strongest points of an earlier date. As we said, even, you know, most historians would think that the book was written 75 to 90 A.D. time frame. And that seems to be right and accurate. Well, you know, the oldest at this point in time, and, you know, archaeologists continue to find ancient scrolls and things like that. You know, the oldest scroll that is found right now, or a portion of the scroll, I should say, you know where it's from? The Gospel of John. And you know what it's dated to be written, as far as that copy was made? 125 to 150 A.D. And so, I mean, that as well kind of debunks all of these ideas that it was written in, you know, 200 or 300 A.D. I mean, it keeps, all the external evidence continues to throw it to an earlier date. That's just kind of interesting, something to kind of tuck away. But then we start talking about internal evidence. And what I mean by that is, what does the book itself say about authorship? And again, I mean, John does not identify himself as Paul does. You know, I, Paul, an apostle of Jesus Christ, as he begins some of his letters. John doesn't do that, and I just wish he did. We wouldn't be having this discussion so much right now. But he didn't do it that way. He kind of removes himself, you know, in some ways in his writing. But the internal evidence is interesting, too, when you look at to see what the book itself has to say about who wrote it. And we talked about that on Wednesday night a little bit. And just looking at the idea of who were some of the closest friends of Jesus, who were those in the inner circle. Because of the things that the writer says in the book of John, it certainly lends itself to the idea that whoever the writer was someone who knew Jesus intimately, who was very close to him. And there were 12 apostles, you know, 14 really in all, but in the time that Jesus was walking the earth, there were 12, you know, until Judas killed himself. And yet there were some, even among the 12, who seemed to stand out as far as the relationship with the Lord goes. We read on Wednesday night about the Transfiguration, as it's recorded in Matthew chapter 17. And it was Peter, James, and John that Jesus took up on the high mountain with him as he was transfigured there. And so, again, we're just noting that to make the point that there were some who were closer to Jesus in that way. And as the story unfolds, even throughout the Gospels, you know, we see Peter, James, and John in prominent positions or roles as far as discussion with the Lord and discussion with those near the Lord. And so that should mean something too as we go through it. But now as we get right into the book of John, I want to look at a couple of passages here. And we're looking to John chapter 21. We're going to the end of the book, really. John chapter 21. And just trying to pick up some things that are written in the book that maybe will give us some clues about authorship. And then ultimately, you have to decide for yourself, you know, if you think John is the writer, if you think it's someone else. But in John chapter 21, we begin reading here at verse 20. Then Peter, turning around, saw the disciple whom Jesus loved following, who also had leaned on his chest at supper and had said, "Lord, who is the one who betrays you?" Well, our question right there starts to form, well, who is that? We'll come to that in a moment. 21. Peter, seeing him, said to Jesus, "Lord, and what will this man do? Referring to the one that was just called out. Jesus said to him, "If I will that he remain till I come, what is that to you? You follow me." Then this saying went out among the brethren that this disciple would not die. Yet Jesus did not say to him that he would not die, but, "If I will that he remain till I come, what is that to you?" This is the disciple who testified of these things and wrote these things, and we know that his testimony is true. And there are also many other things that Jesus did, which, if they were written one by one, I suppose that even the world itself could not contain the books that would be written. All right, just trying to think that through a little bit. What was the relationship of that one with the Lord? The one that's called out. I mean, we're not talking about Peter, because it's Peter who turns around and sees the disciple whom Jesus loved. Well, which one is that? Well, the one who had leaned on his chest at supper, at the supper, and who had said, "Lord, who is the one who betrays you?" Well, most would conclude that that's John that he's speaking of right there. The disciple, and what was his relationship with the Lord? The one whom the Lord loved. Well, how is he described in this text? Well, he leaned on Jesus. He was the one when they were sitting, they're reclining at the supper. He leaned on Jesus. And the one who, as is said here, who had said, "Lord, who is the one who betrays you?" And so the reference is being made to being with Jesus at the supper, the Passover feast, and then Jesus even instituting the Lord's Supper there. And most would say, well, that's John. I mean, that's speaking of John. Well, let's go to chapter 13. We'll go to chapter 13 and look at this episode a little bit closer. And think here, who are the ones with Jesus at the Last Supper? Was it the 12 that were there? We're in John 13, verse 21. When Jesus had said these things, he was troubled in spirit and testified and said, "Most assuredly, I say to you, one of you will betray me." Then the disciples looked at one another, perplexed about whom he spoke. Now there was leaning on Jesus' bosom one of his disciples whom he loved. Simon Peter therefore nodded to him that he should ask who it was of them he spoke, as in, you know, which one would betray him. Then leaning back on Jesus' chest, he said to him, "Lord, who is it?" Here again, John does not identify himself. You know, and Peter doesn't say, "John, why don't you ask him?" I just wish it said that. It would just kind of eliminate a whole lot of questions in that. But here again, just in reading through the fuller text and who was in the room and who was there, who are the closest ones with John, again, most have come to this same conclusion, you know, that it's John that's being spoken of. And so backing up to the bigger picture, narrowing down who is the writer of the book, if you kind of narrow down the field, well, I don't think it's Peter. I mean, in chapter 21, you know, John spoke about Peter. or the writer spoke about Peter, so it wasn't Peter who was doing the writing. You know, so you kind of eliminate Peter out of that. Well, Peter, James, and John are the closest disciples. James died about 40 A.D. Well, he was killed, actually. He was martyred. That kind of takes him out of the picture for a book that was written in 75 to 90 A.D. And so of the closest disciples, the one whom the Lord was spent the most time with, we're down to John. You know, when we come to that point of the inner circle. And even to think about the time of writing, 75 to 90 A.D., many of the disciples or many of the apostles at that point had already died. All of the disciples, all of the apostles met death by martyrdom, except for John, who most say lived to at least 100 A.D., maybe 105 A.D., as far as we can determine, died a natural death. So all of that being said, your thoughts, your questions, what would you add, Wes?
Well, I think I agree with that. I believe it's John, but I think one of the substantive proofs of that, or evidences of that at least, is the style of writing. The
Good
style
point.
Of writing is so different than anyone else's. And then when you look at 1st and 2nd and 3rd John.
Absolutely.
And when you look at Revelation, you see that similar kinds of writing and words being used. For example, in the beginning was the Word.
Right.
Well,
1 John 1.
How does 1 John 1 start?
Yeah.
Well, we've handled the Word of life.
Yeah.
And then in Revelation 19:13, it says, in describing Jesus, said this person has had his robe dipped in blood, and on, I forget exactly the words, but it says his name was written the Word of God. Mm-hmm. So those kinds of things, the stylistic uniformity of those scriptures that we believe are written by John are very consistent in their style, basically.
Right. Good points. Other thoughts? I mean, I'm of the mind, and I've told you this already, that it's the Apostle John that is the writer of the book, and that's kind of the way I'm going forward with the study, you know, that it's John who is the writer. And so let's look at some other aspects here of John as we kind of just get into the lesson, as we get into the story, which we do more in the next lesson. Where was John from? Galilee. I mean, where? How we would narrow it down. I mean, there are cities throughout Galilee, but I don't think we can narrow it down. I haven't found anything where we can narrow it down more so than that. Where are some places that John lived?
Near the sea coast.
He was a fisherman, so he lived near the sea coast somewhere. You know, and could he have been from the towns of the other fishermen? Maybe so. It doesn't really say. Well, after the ascension of Jesus, go ahead, Rick. Mm-hmm.
And weren't John and James partners with Peter?
They were partners.
And the fishing enterprise.
Yes.
So, I mean, that might let us believe.
It makes me think that, you know, that could be the case. Of course, you know, on the northern shore of Galilee, there were some other little towns, too, up and down through there. But it sure lends itself to the idea that they could have very well been from the same town, from Capernaum. I can't really confirm that, but I think that's a good point. Well, where are some other places that we know John lived after the ascension of Christ? And there's at least three places that I can think of.
Did you point it out? Slideshow of Ephesus.
Ephesus?
Eventually, the island of
Ephesus. Yeah. Before that, it would appear he stayed sometime in Jerusalem. In fact, some would say maybe in 15 years. He was likely in and out of there as he was teaching. But, you know, as we go through the book of Acts, it would appear John maybe lived in Jerusalem. And again, some historians kind of believe that to be the case, too. And so we can think of John after the ascension. He's pretty prominent in Jerusalem. In the 40s A.D., he was in Ephesus for a while. And then he was on the Isle of Patmos for a number of years, and then, wait, let me back up. He was in Ephesus, and then it seems he was traveling for a while, perhaps with Peter. And then he was back in Ephesus, probably in the 50s and 60 A.D., maybe 70 A.D. He was there for some period of time, it seems, before going to the Isle of Patmos, being exiled there, and then back to Ephesus. It seems to be where it was when he died. So that's just some things that we know. What is that? What does all that prove in the big picture? Well, really nothing. It's just kind of interesting stuff to think about. You know something about the person. You know some things about John. Let's look at lesson two. And still continuing some thoughts and hoping not to review this too much on some of this. But what we know about the life of John is that it was a full and a long life. And you try to imagine first, I mean, this fishermen from Bethsaida, or at least that area, I should probably just put Galilee, yeah, that he would have, I'm sure he couldn't have dreamed that life would take some of the turns, you know, that it did. And in some ways, you might think that his life was probably already somewhat mapped out. It would appear that his father, Zebedee, had made a pretty good livelihood, you know, being a fisherman. He could call on servants to come and help, and to even have servants just indicate some measure of wealth that he had. And James and John, his sons, were following in their father's footsteps. I mean, growing up, I wonder if he thought of doing anything besides being a fisherman. We have no idea about that. But his life sure took some, you know, extreme turns when Jesus of Nazareth said to him, "Follow me." And so John does not talk about his own calling, so to speak. But you know, some other texts do. I mean, if we go to Luke chapter 5 here just for a moment, just to kind of get a picture of where it started with John, where it started insofar as his relationship with the Lord in Christ's ministry. Now, I make a little bit of emphasis here. His relationship with the Lord as far as the ministry of Christ. You know, it's very much possible that Jesus and John were cousins. You know, and when you go through some of the text, James and John's mother was Salome. And there are those who believe that she was a sister to Mary, the mother of Jesus. And in fact, there's quite a few that would say that and believe that. And so did they know each other growing up? You know, I don't know. I mean, we can't answer these things. But I just think that's another one of those interesting things to kind of tuck away. And there were those who were certainly looking for the Messiah, some more than others, because when Jesus said to some, "Come follow me," you know, they had been looking for the Messiah and knew that this must be him. We're looking at Luke chapter 5. And it came to pass, as the multitude pressed about him to hear the word of God, he stood at the lake of Gennesaret and saw two boats standing by the lake, but the fishermen had gone from them and were washing their nets. And he got into one of the boats, which was Simon's, and asked him to put out a little from the land. And he sat down and taught the multitude from the boat. And when he had stopped speaking, he said to Simon, "Launch out into the deep and let down your nets for a catch." And Simon answered and said to him, "Master, we have toiled all night and taken nothing. Nevertheless, at your word, I will let down the net." And when they had done this, they caught a great number of fish, and their net was breaking. And they signaled to their partners, who were in the other boat, that they should come and help. And they came and filled both the boats, so they began to sink. When Simon Peter saw it, he fell down on his knees, fell down at Jesus' knees, saying, "Depart from me, for I am a sinful man, O Lord." For he and all who were with him were astonished at the catch of fish which they had taken. And so also were James and John, the son of Zebedee, who were partners with Simon. And Jesus said to Simon, "Do not be afraid. From now on you will catch men." And when they had brought their boats to land, they forsook all and followed him. Luke's account tells us something about the Lord calling and James and John, you know, following. John doesn't say anything, you know, much about that. Not in such detail. He doesn't say anything like that. It's just kind of interesting to put that out there as, you know, some perspective, you know, getting some insight here in John. Thoughts or comments? Let's look at the end of the book once again. Going to John chapter 21. We were just here just a moment ago. And before we just get into the text of chapter 1, let's just look at the end of the book. In the final words of John's gospel, we find stated here the purpose in his writing. I want us just to read these things and make some comments. We were in John 21 just a moment ago in verse 25, where the last words in the book says, "And there are also many other things that Jesus did, which if they were written one by one, I suppose that even the world itself could not contain the books that would be written." And as I read that, I'm thinking with John. Well, he was there. I mean, he was a witness of all those things. That's what he's telling us about. Or I should say, that's what he has told us about. We've gone to the end of the book. He's already given his deposition, so to speak. He's already told the story. And now he's saying that there were so many other things. It's just like, I couldn't even tell you all of them. And if I tried to write them down, well, we couldn't even make enough books to write down all the things that Jesus did and all of the things that I saw. Well, that's pretty amazing to think about, because John writes a lot about the things that Jesus did. And we get a lot of insight into the life of Jesus and his purpose and the times that he lived in. And yet it's just like the hem of the garment, so to speak. Turn a page back to chapter 20. Chapter 20 and verse 30. "And truly, Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book, but these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name." Think about that passage and look at it carefully. And let's think about the points that just stand out. The purpose of John's writing. What is it meant to do to us or for us? What is the hope that comes from the writing that's given?
Well, you know, we probably all had conversations with people that said, you know, if I was just there and I saw Jesus and I heard what he said and saw what he did, then I would believe. But what John is telling us here is that these words were written so that we might believe. Mm-hmm. These are what are supposed to instill faith in us.
Right.
And there were people who were there that did not believe as well.
Right. Right. Yeah, that saw the same signs and wonders that John saw, who walked away.
He said
"What?" What else? Look at that passage a minute. I mean, there are just some things here that we just need to grab a hold of. I mean, this is the essence of the book. I mean, he didn't say these things at the beginning, which is a question in itself. Why didn't he say these things at the beginning? Yes. Go for it.
He needed to develop his case first.
He had to put the proof out there first. He had to tell the story first. "And truly Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name."
In case there's somebody here that doesn't understand what signs are, I'm going to explain what we're talking about when we talk about signs.
When we go through the book, we'll see and understand some of the signs that John's talking about. There are, in particular, seven signs or miracles that John records that Jesus did. And these were for the purpose or for the proof of demonstrating that he was the Son of God. It was to confirm the words that Jesus was speaking, you know, and to give credence to the fact that he was, in fact, divine, that he was the Son of God. And so John just makes, you know, reference to the fact that there are many more signs. In fact, some of the other Gospels may call out some signs or miracles that Jesus did that John didn't call out. And even at that, there are many more. You know, here's what John is saying. And so what's the hope that would come from one reading the testimony of John? What is his hope for us?
That might have life. And you know, that goes throughout the book, even from the beginning. That
absolutely.
This idea that in him was life, and the life was the light of men.
It's interesting. And it begins and it ends on some of the same things.
It does, that's right. And there's, I think, a distinctive purpose for that sense that we all get life from there's some origin. Each of us has a parent. You have parents. And they had parents. And they had parents. And all the way back to Adam and Eve. But in him was life. Mm-hmm. In other words, he is the origin and the author of life. He didn't get it from someone else. Mm-hmm. It was in him. Life was in him.
And the life that he's going to define to us is not just life breathing in oxygen, but life eternal. That's the life. All right, good thoughts.
That might even give us an idea of why John didn't say, "I, John, wrote this." He wanted the emphasis to be on Christ, not John.
Absolutely. And I think that's a good point. That's kind of a standout point with the writing. You know, I mean, John was someone of some significance in and of himself, being an apostle of Christ. But you don't see that come out in the writing. At least I don't see that. The focus and the emphasis is on Christ. That's part of the beauty of the writing. Yeah. You know, the book of John is just so interesting from the standpoint that it's a book that is very simple in some ways, and yet it's very deep in others. I mean, the simplest mind, which that would be the category that I'm in, you already figured that part out. The simplest mind can go through the book of John and go, "Wow, that really helped me. You know, that has increased my faith." And yet you can read the book of John again and you can find another level. I don't care how many times you read through it, you can take a deep dive as you meditate on it, and you can always find something more, you know, to the book of John. And I would emphasize, I don't think that's necessarily because of any special skill set of the writer of John, but it says something about the influence that inspired him, about the inspiration that the Lord had on him, and certainly the Spirit as he wrote these things. But, Denny, go ahead.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
But once he starts telling stories,
you're hooked.
Get drawn in.
That's right.
And
that's right.
Storyteller is going to draw you in.
You ever start reading a book and you get a little bit too anxious and you go and you read the last chapter? You know, and now you know the ending of the story. I mean, and now in some stories, that just ruins the story. It takes the challenge out of reading the story if you know how it ends already. It's like watching, I can't hardly ever watch a movie twice. If I already know what the movie is and how it ends, why would you watch it again? I mean, of course, a lot of people do that. They can watch a movie over and over and over again, you know. If I sit down and start watching a movie, it's like, I've already seen this, you know. I'm ready to go do something else. Well, sometimes reading a book is that way, too. If you already know how it ends, you know, it's harder to read through. The gospel's not so much that way. But a lot of books are like that. That's it. So you're in favor of watching a movie 20 times. Is that what you're saying? and some books you can do that with, and movies are that way. You're right, because there's something you pick up every time when you see it.
I was also thinking along the lines of if he opened the book by telling them that it was written so that they may believe, if people are stuck in unbelief and they don't want to change,
right.
That would put their guard up.
That's right. I mean, the skeptics might stop reading right then. Those who have sort of determined in their mind, oh, I don't believe. Well, they haven't even heard the story. They don't even know what to believe or not to believe. But if they're told, when you read this, you will believe, no. Some might not, might read it. That's a good point. It,
you know, something that strikes me when I'm, you know, listening to the gospel too, and I know part of it's the interpretation, but the eloquence of the language, mm-hmm. you know, and how that, that person communicates, you know, through the words to us even now. And these were not learned people, you know, they were
fishermen.
They were fishermen. With some extent, yeah. So, yeah. You know, I guess that's just a point that, you know, they were able to give us this information in this really understandable form,
right?
And with hardly any education in that regard as to how to write this stuff.
You see, you know, I think we talked about this some the other night. It's like when you read through the Gospels, you do see the personality each of the writers. That's true, all the books, but. As we kind of compare the Gospels, we see the difference in the writers, the men. Personality comes out. And yet you certainly have to acknowledge the influence of the Holy Spirit in the writing, and the consistency of the writing. Emily and Rick. And this is an interesting point. You know, the Matthew, Mark, and Luke are believed to have been written, you know, quite a bit earlier than John's account. And I think it can sort of be looked at as like, I mean, the other accounts may have been out there and may have been read, and now John's account comes, which is telling some of the same stories, telling some of the same events, you know, with Jesus in a little bit different way, and perhaps in some points with a little more depth, you know, as far as where it's reaching or where it's leading. That's an interesting point.
You mentioned something that caused me to ask a question in my head, and that's that John presented seven miracles in the book. Did he even know? Was he even counting? Or did he just present those seven miracles? And the reason I'm saying that is because he's inspired by the Holy Spirit. He's writing what the Spirit is giving him to write. So he may not even be aware of these things.
There's some discussion in when we get into the chapter 2 about when we start into the miracles, the seven miracles. There's some other sevens too in the book, and we'll discuss that a little bit when we get there. It's just kind of interesting to think about. Does it mean anything? I don't know. But it's just interesting to note. Liz.
Well, I was just kind of adding on to Emily's point about the synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark. Yeah. If you just look at the first chapter of John, there's no, it says the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld His glory, the glory of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. But there's no wise men, there's no manger, there's no travel from, mm-hmm. you know, to Bethlehem, there's no night in the inn. There, none of those details are in the nativity scene or the events surrounding that are so prominent in Luke particularly, but in the others as well. John has none of that. Those are kind of the facts of the situation, as Emily said, but John takes a different approach to the description of who this person is that became the flesh and dwelt among us. Mm-hmm. And that just kind of came out of my mind.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting point. Sure.
I don't know if John has written, the book of John was written while John was exiled or not, but just occurs to me how much of the New Testament maybe wouldn't have been written if it weren't for the apostles being imprisoned or mm-hmm. or being exiled.
They're feeling some duress in some way. You know, that's an interesting point.
That's right. Time on my hands as well.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, sending, got to do something. Let's write a letter to Timothy today. You know, perhaps there's a factor in it, or it could be even that in prison, you know, needing some encouragement. I'm going to write my brother Timothy in different ways of considering that. We've mentioned here, you know, of course, John spent some time on the Isle of Patmos, was exiled there. And I'm sure the experience was not meant to be a pleasant experience. I mean, to be exiled to Patmos was to take you out of society, take you away from contact with others. And it would many would believe that he was exiled to a cave, you know, on the Isle of Patmos. It's kind of interesting, of course, the Isle of Patmos is still there today, that you can look at some pictures, some photos of the Isle of Patmos. Well, it's very pretty. I mean, when I think of John being exiled to the Isle of Patmos, I can only see dungeons in my mind. And again, I'm sure he wasn't put on a beautiful island and it was made nice for him. He was in prison on an island. You know, it was not made nice. But I'm just saying that today, I mean, that island's out in the Aegean Sea, very dark blue sea and green growth on the island. Pictures I've seen of it in today's time, you know, it's a very pretty area. Now, what does that have to do with this? I don't know. I just thought of it and thought I'd mention it to you. But as we think about Patmos, we've spoke some about just, you know, the influence that had come upon John through Jesus, you know, to now do this writing. I mean, the things that he had seen, the experience that he had had with the Lord. And you can't help but wonder how that changed him. And we really have to stop and think about and wonder and hope and pray that the Lord has changed us and has influenced us in such a way to make us the people that we need to be. And one of the reasons I bring that up is because, I mean, after the gospel accounts, you know, we read through the book of Acts, we read about Peter and John and James, even the brother of John for a while, to the 12th chapter of Acts, and James is no more. But the influence that Jesus had on his disciples is something that we need to have in mind. You know, on one occasion when being questioned by the Jewish council, this observation was made. When there was Peter and John and the other apostles who were preaching, they've been told not to preach, but they keep on preaching, and the enthusiasm that they had and the stories that they were telling was just, you know, overwhelming to those who were hearing. And in Acts chapter 4 and verse 13, now when they saw the boldness of Peter and John and perceived that they were uneducated and common men, they were astonished, and they recognized that they had been with Jesus. It's like that says everything. You know, when they looked at Peter and John, these fishermen, you know, perhaps not the best educated. I somehow have a picture in my mind of some guys that were a little bit rough. And yet here they were preaching the gospel of Jesus Christ and doing so with great enthusiasm and boldness, even when they've been told not to. And yet the observation of the Jewish leaders of the time, when they looked at these common men, they were just astonished. But it occurred to them that they had been with Jesus. I mean, doesn't that say a lot? And, I mean, I can't help but think about that. And even as we go through our lives day to day and we come in contact with a lot of different people in different places, I wonder if people walk away and turn back and look at us and say, he knows Jesus. Because they can see in our life something different. They can see an attitude about us, a manner of life that's different than the world. Can they see that in us? That could be seen in John. The one who, years after that event in Acts chapter 4, years of seasoning and maturity and difficulties in life, has not forgotten the experience with Jesus. And writes to us in such a way and in a fashion that when we read it, it's like we get it. We can understand the influence of the Lord. We can understand how the Lord changed his life. And that's what John is writing about. I mean, that is his hope, that after we read the book, that our lives will be changed because of belief, because of faith in Jesus Christ. So much so that we will want to be like him. That's the focus of the writing. That's the focus of the book. Closing thoughts, closing remarks.
Another thing that teaches us is that there's more than one way to get an education.
Yeah.
You don't have to go to a entire learning to get an education. If we sit at the feet of Jesus, we will get an education.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Right.
I think it's interesting that we do not hear John speak even in appreciation or reverence to Mary in all his writings.
Why is that?
I think it's obvious. It's the point is Jesus, not the mother.
There are those, of course, today who would give great reverence to Mary, worship her, really. And what's interesting, Grant, is that to whom did Jesus give the responsibility of caring for his mother? To John. And there are those who say, in fact, I don't think I showed a picture of this in the pictures of Ephesus. There is also a temple or a shrine built to Mary, the mother of Jesus, in Ephesus. And there are those who would believe, and historians who would say, that Mary, the mother of Jesus, was with John when he moved to Ephesus. You know, I don't know if that's true. I don't know that we can know for sure that that's true. But I can understand that. Jesus gave that responsibility to John as a brother. Take care of my mother. Jesus knew he was going to die. And John did that. And yet it is interesting that John doesn't write about Mary in a glowing way as to raise or lift her up in any position. But he certainly does that of Jesus. That's an interesting point, key point.
And that point with Mary, one of the key phrases I think is what happens there with Mary and the wedding feast of Cana. And what Mary said was, whatever he tells you to do, do it to the servants.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a pretty good saying right there.
That's right. That's right.
Any one of us could say that, but Mary said that, you know, as a mother of Jesus, whatever he tells you.
Because she had already taken into her heart things that Jesus had done and things that she had seen. She knew there was something about Jesus. Good conversation. Good thoughts today. Lord willing, on Wednesday night, we're going to take up right here about the middle of page 3. We're going to work through the first 18 verses or so. That's your focus for Wednesday night. The first 18 verses. We're going into the doctrinal study.